space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Thank you.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Today we're going to, let's see here, what's the word I'm looking for? Today we're going to explore the reasoning why Doomsday sucks. Anyway, so let's just get into it. You're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html. where you have access to not one, but four separate chat rooms and links to other chat rooms, such as People for People Radio Network. If you're on the Super Chat chat room, you can click, scroll down and click on the People for People radio banner there, and go over there and say hi to those wonderful folks. So anyway, let's just get into it. Let's start with this right here.
The Doomsday Preppers, and they say the whole mess in Washington is but one sign of impending disaster. And these guys are not taking any chances. Here's ABC's David Wright.
What if the end came not with a bang, or a boom, or the blast of a trumpet, the seventh trumpet of Revelations, that is, heralding the final woe of the apocalypse? No, what if the end were self-inflicted? What if all it took was a breakdown of the political system we all take for granted to trigger the ultimate collapse of civil society? A collapse significant enough to cause a run on the banks and the gas pumps and the grocery store shelves. That's a doomsday scenario. And that's the lens through which doomsday preppers view what's been going on in Washington this week.
The economy is by far number one. I would say 80 to 90% of the people that I deal with, they're concerned about where the country's heading economically. They're worried about their future jobs.
Scott Hunt runs a Doomsday Academy of sorts in South Carolina, training people to be self-sufficient in the end of days. His company, Practical Preppers, is a one-stop shop for survival. The last few weeks, he says, business has been booming.
We've seen a considerable uptick in emails, phone calls, a lot of contact through social media for help. Whether it's teaching, whether it's equipment, installations, information.
Hunt is also a consultant for the National Geographic Channel show Doomsday Preppers. He says his customers are deeply concerned.
I mean, it's unsettling when the government doesn't function, and the government's there to serve and protect its people. And when it's not functioning, then there is, you know, there's an uneasiness in people from all walks of life.
He says one of the big things his customers fear is anarchy. To them, it doesn't matter if anarchy is brought on by natural or man-made disaster.
We are the 99%.
Doesn't matter whether it's encouraged by left-wing activists angry at big corporations or right-wing activists angry at big government. Either way, the result they see is the same. In the future they see, it's every man and every woman for themselves.
I'm preparing for an economic collapse.
Kurt is one of the stars of the new season of Doomsday Preppers.
The government has been infiltrated. It's been infiltrated by corporations, banks, financial institutions, labor unions, and a lot of special interests.
What scares him the most is the crushing burden of U.S. debt. Yes, even the deficit means doomsday to some people.
When our $16 trillion becomes due, we will be in big trouble and the government will be shut down, basically.
He's played out the movie in his head, and to him it looks an awful lot like Mad Max. Or The Road, post-apocalyptic.
When I have nothing else, I try to dream the dreams of a child's imaginings.
All the things that we take for granted every single day could possibly be gone. Gas for your car to get anywhere. Electricity could become an issue. Food will not be at your grocery store any longer. I think it could get really desperate and nasty.
Christine and Zoltan Heights don't necessarily look like survivalists. She's a stay-at-home mom. He's a tennis instructor. They recently spent $800 each and a three-day weekend learning how to escape if you're handcuffed in the trunk of a car and other survival lessons.
I'm not worried. I just want to be prepared.
Something's on the rumble, and if you can't, I think most people are anxious. I think most people can feel it. Who knows what it's going to be or where it's going to be, but I'd like to be prepared.
Prepared for even the most extreme crisis.
I worry about my girls and myself, and if something were to happen to him, I want to be able to take care of myself just as easily.
There's survival instructor Kevin Reeve,
drop my knees,
who used to market software for Apple, says increasingly the people he trains are middle-class folks like the Heights.
I'm getting a lot more citizens, just normal, everyday civilian American citizens who are saying, oh, you know what, things are not going really good.
Okay, now put one on each toe.
These folks are not crazy. In fact, you could argue that concern about the future of humanity is part of what makes us human. Over the centuries, the collective response to those existential concerns have given rise to the world's great religions. Faith of any sort may well be the ultimate manifestation of survivalism, a bulwark against humanity's extinction, offering reassurance that in the grand scheme, we'll come out okay. In the modern era, technology has given us new things to fear and new ideas how to survive.
Duck and cover under the table.
Baby boomers grew up with it.
Duck and cover. Attaboy, Tony.
So it's hardly surprising so many should turn to it now. They fall into two basic camps. There are the preppers, people like Tim Ralston, stockpiling for the inevitable.
Oh my God. Quite a man cave.
He's taken over the family's two-car garage in Scottsdale and turned it into a staging area, crammed with canned food and water purification system.
Not bad.
Not bad. Sugary.
And weapons. Lots of weapons and ammo. He's planning to bury his cash in a container deep in the desert, and he's training his sons to defend it. At the other extreme, there are folks who take a less aggressive approach. Not the preppers, but the wilderness survivalists. People like Tom Brown, who runs a school where he trains people to live off the land. They see the preppers as potential victims of their own preparation.
Looking at that approach to survival, you are in prison. You're imprisoned by your structure. You're imprisoned by your supplies, your ammunition, your guns, everything involved. In fact, there's maps that you can get off the internet that tell you where these bunkers are. I don't want to be in one of those bunkers because it's called a supermarket.
As of tonight, both the preppers and the survivalists can breathe a bit easier. The fact that in Washington, doomsday didn't come this time doesn't convince them they were wrong to fear it. As they see it, they now have a bit more time to get ready. I'm David Wright for Nightline in Los Angeles.
Okay, so, there's a little bit of a start right there. Where to start? That's the big question. See, if you take a listen around about all the doomsday preppers and actually government preparation and stuff like that, continuity of government, which I'm going to get into as well, but it's just mind-blowing of how many different types of scenarios that it could actually come about or that people were concerned about, when in reality the government seems to be the only one that is preparing for anything. So let me just move on real quick here. Now, I don't agree with all of what you're going to hear on this little podcast, but whatever.
Ten apocalypses that we survived. Number 10, the Black Death. The Black Death is probably the most famous plague ever to hit humanity, but most people don't realize it's taken a huge chunk out of the world's population on more than one occasion. Yersinia pestis, the bacterium responsible for the bubonic plague, had its first breakout appearance in 541 CE. Known as the Plague of Justinian, the disease swept through the Byzantine Empire, killing 5,000 people a day for over a year. Eventually, around 50 million people died, 25% of the world's population at the time. Then in 1346, the plague re-emerged as the Black Death. Giant swellings appeared on victims' bodies as they fell into fevers and started throwing up blood. Oh, and they died. Anywhere from 75 million to 200 million people were killed by the Black Death. But I guess no one was massively worried about keeping exact records when all their friends were busy vomiting up blood. Roughly 60% of Europe's population disappeared, and the world population didn't reach pre-plague levels until 250 years later. There was even a third plague outbreak in China in 1855, taking another 10 million people out. Yet humanity survived all of it. Or at least, we have so far. Technically, the plague still exists. Number 9, the Ice Age. Nowadays, it only has to dip below room temperature to send most of us reaching for a Snuggie. So it's pretty incredible that humans managed to survive through the Ice Age. Yet that's exactly what scientists now know happened, at least according to research from a journal so scientifically sciencey they called it Science. The paper dates recently discovered human fossils as 37,000 years old, meaning mankind managed to tough its way through the Ice Age, which is pretty impressive considering that the Ice Age was basically 30,000 years of Mother Nature trying to freeze us off the Earth. With temperatures dipping around the world and plants dying, life suddenly became much harder. Every subspecies of human except Homo sapiens, that's us, and Neanderthals, a dumber version of us, died out. Some scientists think that we only made it through the freezing era because a few hundred of us happened to find a small warm region 200 odd miles east of modern day Cape Town. Those lucky few are thought to be the only humans who survived the Ice Age. Yet, ice literally whittled our entire species down to a few hundred people. Fortunately, our ancestors just about managed to survive sitting through the Ice Age. Although, to this day, there is no proof that any human has ever survived sitting all the way through Ice Age 2 to 5. Number 8. 2012 Solar Flare. In 1859, the Earth was struck with a massive solar storm. While everyone was messing about doing Victorian-y things like trying on corsets and growing amazing mustaches, a bizarre white light appeared over Australia. Although two astronomers, Richard Carrington and Richard Hodgson, spotted the event, there was no effect to society as a whole. But that wouldn't have been the case had it happened today. You see, the solar flare that struck the Earth would have interfered with our modern power grid, crippling it and forcing us to live without power. That means no artificial light, no internet for information, no communication more advanced than shouting, and worst of all, no more selfies. The scary thing is this almost happened in 2012. In that year, there was a massive solar storm that just missed the Earth. And I mean just. If the storm had started 6 minutes earlier, our planet would have been hit, and according to NASA, we'd still be picking up the pieces. Number 7. Tunguska Event. When not trying to kill us with solar flares, space has a simpler, if less elegant, solution: chucking giant rocks at us. We all know a meteorite wiped out the dinosaurs, but the event that turned the T-Rex from King Lizard to Smithsonian exhibit was far from a one-off. In 1908, a meteorite rocketed into our atmosphere and started plummeting to the ground. It landed at Tunguska in the middle of Siberia, which is just another way of saying the middle of nowhere. It's lucky the meteorite landed where it did. The impact was 1,000 times more powerful than an A-bomb, and 80 million trees were uprooted by the blast. People hundreds of kilometers away claim to have heard the explosion, and there are reports of windows breaking in nearby towns. Considering the damage one A-bomb did to Hiroshima or Nagasaki, something with 1,000 times the power would have wiped out even the largest city. Had the meteorite's path differed slightly, the comet could have hit Moscow, turning the city to dust and dramatically changing the course of history. Number 6. Population Collapse. A million years ago, humanity came to the brink of extinction, and the scariest thing, we don't even know how it happened. Scientists researching Neolithic man have found that our population suddenly and mysteriously bottlenecked. In other words, the number of humans plummeted, some think to as low as 18,000. That's low enough to make human beings an endangered species. There are a number of theories as to how this happened, but the two most prominent theories are these. Either A, we suffered from some mass extinction event like a giant earthquake or a volcanic eruption, or B, we became overpopulated in one region and killed off our food supply there. Whatever happened, it was enough to have a long-term impact on the population. Fossil evidence suggests that the number of humans stayed around 18,000 for tens of thousands of years. With a headcount so low, humans were extremely vulnerable, and another cataclysmic event could easily put an end to our species. Permanently. Number 5. Shanxi Earthquake. If you woke up to find 60% of China had died, it'd probably feel something like an apocalypse, especially if all those people had just been wiped out by a single event. Well, that happened once. In 1556, Shanxi province in northern China was hit with an earthquake so powerful it reached 7.9 on the Richter scale. For the non-earthquake experts among you, that's 10 times as powerful as the earthquake that devastated Haiti in 2010. The impact of this China-shaking event was massive. 830,000 people died. That may not sound like a lot compared with the Black Death or the Ice Age, but actually it was a whopping 60% of the population of central China. That's the equivalent of an earthquake killing 780 million people nowadays. The cost of the damage is impossible to measure, but it almost caused the Chinese government and economy to collapse. A similar collapse today would bring the world economy to its knees, sparking chaos and destruction around the world. Number 4. Permian-Triassic extinction. By now, you've probably got the idea that mankind has survived some pretty intense things. We've been hit with diseases, natural disasters, and giant rocks from space. Yet we've clung on and outlived it all. But humans almost didn't get the chance to be plucky little survivors. In fact, we were almost wiped out long before we even existed. Way back in 250 million BCE, when we were still handsome little rat things, there was a mass extinction event that almost ended life on Earth. Though there's disagreement as to what exactly happened, many experts agree that the formation of the massive continent Pangaea blocked the oceans around it from flowing properly. This led to the water becoming stagnated and deadly. Bad news if you're a little rat thing. The stagnant water poisoned almost everything in it, killing 96% of all marine life. But it didn't stop there. Not having a reliable source of clean water also proved fatal to 70% of land-based species. The Permian-Triassic extinction was so devastating to the Earth that NASA refers to it as the Great Dying. Fortunately, our ancestors managed to struggle through, and now you get to sit here watching YouTube videos. Number 3. Spanish Flu. We've already seen what the bubonic plague could do when let loose on medieval Europe, but in those days the most advanced medical science got was saying, just throw some leeches at it and try not to upset any witches. For a plague to be as deadly in the 20th century when we had a decent grounding in disease prevention seems almost impossible, yet that's exactly what Spanish flu achieved. In 1918, Spanish flu spread rapidly around the world, infecting 250 million people. The disease turned having a strong immune system into a deadly weakness, causing bodies to overreact to the pathogen by sending countless T cells to the infected area. These cells were often sent in such high concentrations that they blocked the airways to the lungs, causing people to drown in their own fluids. Basically, the disease tricked your body into doing the equivalent of trying to remove facial acne with a shotgun. The disease disappeared by the end of the year, probably mutating into a less deadly strain of flu, but in the short time it had killed 50 million people. A re-emergence of the Spanish flu remains Bill Gates' biggest fear for the future. In fact, he rates the odds of it happening within his lifetime as 50-50. Number 2. World War 2. You don't need us to tell you that World War II was a pretty big deal. Over 25 million soldiers perished in the conflict, and 50 million civilians were murdered. Add in the victims of the Holocaust, and that brings the total to a staggering 85 million deaths. But the war was almost even more deadly than that. We now know that Hitler had his Nazi scientists working around the clock to develop a nuclear weapon. From 1939 onwards, the German nuclear program grew even closer to successfully splitting the atom. Some even claimed that they were on the verge of completing an atomic bomb, and that he already had plans drawn up to nuke London and New York. In a gratifying display of karma, the fact the Nazis were never quite able to rain nuclear hell down on us was in large part due to their own bigotry. All the prominent Jewish physicists in the country had been killed off or fired, leaving the Nazis without many of the leading experts they could have relied on. Number 1. Toba Supervolcano. When you hear the term supervolcano, you know things are about to get real, and the Toba Supervolcano is no exception. As devastating as all the other events on this list have been, this was the closest mankind ever came to extinction. In 70,000 BCE, while humans were still learning which end of the spear to use, the Toba supervolcano suddenly exploded. And we mean exploded. Experts of the real and epically named Volcanic Explosivity Index describe the eruption as mega colossal. Yet, this thing was so big it caused scientists to make up a word just to convey its awesomeness. The heat and power of the eruption vaporized 2,800 kilometers of surrounding rock, sending it all into the atmosphere. For comparison, the Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980 only managed to destroy 1 kilometer of rock. As you might imagine, 2,800 kilometers of rock dust being blasted into the sky isn't great for the environment. The dust blackened out most of the sun's light for 6 years. With little plant life and increasingly sparse prey, most people starved. The global population dropped to around 3,000, and the number of breeding adults left may have fallen as low as 80. Yes, if 80 people hadn't screwed, we wouldn't be here today. That's pretty scary, but there is good news. The fact that only the smartest and most resourceful humans managed to survive probably made us a better species in the long run. So those were 10 apocalypses that we survived. Which near catastrophic crisis was your favourite? Did we leave any humanity threatening moments off the list? And if you want to see some apocalypses we might not be able to make it through, check out Top 10 Global Apocalypses That Could Happen Today, playing on screen now.
So, when you got all these people worried about all the different types of possibilities as far as apocalyptic events and, you know, doomsday type scenario, I always come back to the same doggone question. The governments of the world, they seem to plan for these type of events and build bunkers and all kinds of different things, which, you know, I want to get into as well. But the general population, when the government runs up into their bunker, unless you are lucky and you win some sort of lottery or you're some sort of vital person in the government, you're just left outside. So you don't have a ticket, a golden ticket to the ark, so to speak. you don't get to go up inside the bunker. So according to calculations, they say there's over 7 billion people on the planet right now. So that means that not all those 7 billion people are actually going to be able to fit inside the bunker. And that leaves you outside. So all your work and your sacrifice that you've done building society and paying your taxes goes in to keep continuity of a government, whichever country you're in. And they have all the nifty tools and things to try to keep control once, you know, something happens. World War III or, you know, some massive natural calamity or whatever. And so, once again, I'm back to the same exact question. What about we the people? What kind of plan do we got? Most folks don't have a plan. And those who do are called crazy. And those who do but don't have a plan, their plan isn't necessarily the friendly one. It's like the guys and gals that say, well, I'm not going to store up anything. I'll just go out whenever all heck breaks loose and I'll just take what I want. And it's going to come out there and rob and rape and loot and pillage and stuff like that. So I'm thinking, with all the technology we have available to us, we literally have enough technology and knowledge of materials that we could build nearly indestructible houses to withstand any thing that nature could pretty much throw at you at any given time. But we don't do that as just a general population. We don't do that. We basically tiptoe through the tulips and think the government's got this and everything's going to be just fine. We don't stress out over any of that stuff. You know, we're too busy with life, you know, building up our little circles or whatever we think we're building, our castles. So I'm thinking, imagine a society where it was a regular thing that people would actually prepare for just such an emergency that things could go wrong. And, you know, that's including actually built the way that you construct your house, you know, the way that you construct your buildings that you're going to be working or sleeping in or whatever. And so if you live in a flood zone, there's people that live in the flood zone, they actually build their houses to when the water rises, the whole house floats up and is locked into place by some big old tall poles and stuff like that. Got like a springy cord on the power line so that, you know, they can keep the power on as long as the power's on in wherever. But that's pretty ingenious. And there's other people who live in places where, you know, it's like ridiculously cold, and they seem to be able to survive through all that. So it's not like past ice ages or, you know, even diseases have wiped out the entire planet. as far as you know, population goes. But we could prepare for all of this stuff way prior to any event happening. Imagine if there was a tsunami or a doggone hurricane or whatever, and your houses, even your vehicles for that matter, were built to withstand that kind of stuff. So basically, if your car gets caught in a flood, it floats. We got the technology to do that. You know, maybe it cost a few more pennies out of the bucket to actually create these kind of things. But in the long term, aren't we talking about the survivability of humans? You know, we got all these wars and stuff going on for ridiculous reasons. And we continue to basically pay for all these things. We go to work, we pay our taxes, pay our fines and everything so that we can survive. And when it's all said and done, if anything does happen, it's only the upper echelon that actually get to go into the bunker. Now, unless you're a millionaire or a rich person that you can afford to build your own doomsday bunker, and even under that particular scenario, did you plan for every possible event? Flooding, earthquake, solar storms, whatever. You know, any of the possible doomsday scenarios that you can think about. All of which can be defended against. Every single bit of reasons why people's houses blow over in 300 mile an hour wind or whatever. You know, tornado comes through, it rips the doggone house completely apart. We could build geometrical shaped structures that the wind would just wrap right around and go on by. You know, you could build your house like a boat. You could take all the technology from every different sector, and you could combine it in, and yes, that's Troy said is called a boat. Yeah, you had a boat during the flood. That's brilliant. See, and it's not even rocket science. That's the crazy thing about it. But we don't think like that as the average Joe. We just kind of buy us a piece of property somewhere if we get lucky and able to do that, or we rent some place, and you know, it just keeps the rain off your head or the cold off your back or whatever. It's something that it just don't make any sense. We're living in the year 2019 and we still build houses out of sticks. We build houses out of bricks in flood zones. So if your house is going to potentially get blown over, or it's going to potentially get caught fire to, washed downstream, then maybe you might want to think about either building it somewhere in a more sound area, or building it to withstand certain types of events. All of them, as a matter of fact. You know, you could build the perfect houses. They wouldn't even have to actually be like houses. You know, it could be almost like a big old giant flying saucer sitting in your front yard. You know. And you could get inside this thing, and it didn't matter if it flooded or whatever. It doesn't matter if it was a hailstorm outside or even a doggone nuclear apocalypse. As long as it didn't hit you directly, it would withstand it. It'd have its own built-in Faraday cage against electromagnetic pulses, or it would have its own cooling system. It'd be able to reflect solar radiation. And you know, you see it in science fiction movies all the time. You see people building these big giant ships and flying through space, and you know, space is supposedly a vacuum, and it's really cold and hostile out there with all different types of radiations and stuff like that, and things could fly around and hit you. We even have the technology to build force fields that could literally repel things that were coming at you. If it's got any kind of iron in it, you could either attract it to you or you could repel it using magnetic technologies. There's all kinds of different options available. But we live like there's always going to be a tomorrow or something. And if you listen to some of these doomsday preppers, one of the most simplest one would be a society collapse where people just went nuts, you know, out there protesting and burning down their own communities. Well, maybe you might want to get the doggone community built so in case these people decide they want to tear everything out, you can lock your house down. You know, you got this metal shutters that'll just roll around your house and keep anything from being able to get in. That kind of deal. Keep your house from being able to catch on fire. We have the technology to do that. Of course, the average Joe don't have the finances to do that. But maybe we, if we were working together, we could resolve this. You know, back in the old days when they were worried about nuclear war with Russia, they built all kinds of bunkers. And then they teach the kids in school, well, if there's an attack, just duck and cover your head. Really? And that's going to help you how? I mean, you got a nuclear blast coming, throwing all kinds of crud and radioactive material around, and basically ducking and cover is going to save you. Maybe you'll get lucky. Maybe whatever wall or school desk you're underneath is going to be sturdy enough to withstand the building collapsing on it. I don't know. I mean, common sense dictates if it could go wrong, it usually does go wrong. That's Murphy's Law. And so I would think that we would want to try to resolve these issues so that, you know, while the government's up inside their bunkers, we the people are out here in ours. You don't never hear the government saying, hey, build you a bunker. No, actually, they kind of discourage against it because they're worried that if you build a bunker, you might try to overthrow the government. And that's never been the plan. It's just survival. You want to take care of your family. You want to survive. But how are you going to survive when you're left out in the deal with the zombies or the aliens or, you know, the hostile military or, you know, natural disasters or whatever? And heck, even to that extent, the government actually is responsible for a lot of disasters that could come about. You know, spraying crud in the air, that's not healthy. Doing all this different fracking and cracking up the ground and causing sinkholes and earthquakes and stuff like that. That's not healthy. That's not a wise idea. But, you know, yeah. Troy says, pretty much, I can't repeat it on air, but yeah, kiss yourself goodbye. That's it. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think we should just give up like that. I think that the average Joe ought to get together with all their neighbors and say, hey, look, these governments, they all got these bunkers. They got these really expensive planes that we paid for that they can go fly in the air and be miles above any kind of nuclear explosion and survive. And you paid for that. All of you paid for that. And some of you probably even helped build it. That's the crazy thing about it. But when it comes to your family, because you don't have the money, what's that? Where's that leave you? You can't go out there and afford to build a bunker. But if you get five other people in your community, you guys could and gals could build a community shelter for you. That way, if something really did go on, you could at least try to survive. I mean, just stand out there and, hey, you know, it's over. Okay, see y'all later. Been nice knowing you. No, I don't think that's the way we should let this go down. I don't think we should pay for the government's paid vacation in a luxury bunker with all the, the good stuff. Well, we're all left out here to survive the Mad Max version of Road Warrior or whatever, you know. We're getting attacked by gangs and people want to steal everything we got. No, we need to come together before any type of scenario like that. We need to build an infrastructure that would actually, you know, support us during a time like that. Power outages or whatever. We have all the alternative energy stuff we need. We just need to be smart enough to put the pieces of the puzzle together. But you know, it's not just up to me by myself. It's up to everybody who wants to do this. You know, there's certain people, they'll run off and move into a cave down in Arkansas or whatever, Ozarks. Nothing ever happened. You know, there wasn't no doomsday. There wasn't no 2012 Y2K thing. It didn't happen. Doomsday keeps on getting moved. There's people that believe that there's a planet coming and it's getting ready to destroy us. Whether it is or it isn't, what are we going to do about it? You know? We could build at least life pods that you could get inside there and rough out the storm. Something. As long as it floats and, you know, the wind don't smash it up against a tree or doesn't take a direct nuclear hit, there's a good chance you're going to be all right when the storm clears. So anyway, I want to keep on going with this right here. I might pause during certain parts, but it just blows my mind. All these different government, secret bunkers and underground cities and stuff like that. You're not invited. Unless you're somebody special, you don't get a golden ticket. So, are we all just going to, because I don't have much money in my pocket and you don't have much money in your pocket, not try to at least work together to do something to ensure that a decent part of humanity survives? Because the folks that they're putting up in the bunkers, those are the folks that most people don't like. You know, those are the rich, wealthy folks that, have influence and power. And some of the people that you might think are going to be in there may not be welcome either. So, who's to say? And what type of government would actually come out of when it was all said and done? Would you even know your own country if something like that came about? But imagine this. All heck breaks loose, and we all already had a plan all along. We're not going to be out in the cold. We're not going to die just because the government threw us to the wolves. You know, hey, we weren't worthy enough to go. Our elderly, they already lived their life. That kind of mentality. You know, crazy stuff. So, I'm saying, if the average Joe had any common sense whatsoever, they would be talking amongst each other. How would we fix all this stuff? We just going to go out and rob, rape, and loot and pillage and take what we want? Are we going to work together to ensure that we don't have to live through some sort of crazy experience like Mad Max, Road Warrior, Beyond Thunderdome kind of deal? You know? With gangs and everything. Go watch the video series called Jericho. When you see that video series called Jericho, think about what you want your family living in that kind of scene. It's crazy. Let's keep on going here.
The federal government's ready for the moment of disaster. As mushroom clouds plume, key politicians and federal staffers would be rushed underground. The sites are prepared, humming along with daily activity right now, and hidden from the public. If you're invited, you already know it. If not, you're sort of on your own. Some new facilities have been built up over the last few years, and Garrett Graff found one by accident. While writing about national security for Washingtonian Magazine, Graff told NPR he came into possession of a federal employee's badge. On the back, when he flipped it around, it had driving directions. Google Maps showed nothing there, so Graff hopped in the car, and when he arrived at the site in West Virginia, he said the road dead ends into the side of a mountain.
Okay, let me pause that right there. Secret government underground deal nobody knows about, not even on Google Maps. In the chat room, Troy said it has no money. But the thing about it is, regardless of whether you have money or not, you have skills, you have resources, and those are all valuable. Because the biggest thing in any type of scenario like that would be the fact that doomsday, you're not going to have all the access to the computers and all that kind of stuff. It's that knowledge that you got in your head that's going to make or break the system. And even if you are able to save some technology back, that's going to be a plus. So whatever computers you got, whatever kind of resources you got, it, regardless of whether you got money in your pockets, money ain't going to make a difference anyway. You're not going to be able to go to the store and buy anything. There ain't even going to be no use for money. Unless you got gold or silver and somebody still wants the shiny stuff. But for the most part, what's really going to matter is resources like food, water, and fuel. That kind of stuff. But if you know how to make all that, then that makes you a valuable commodity in any type of scenario. That means you have value in that. And even if you're just somebody who can cook or entertain or something like that, the same thing. Life's going to have to go on no matter what. So, anyway, let me finish with this. Let's keep going here. But money's not the problem. If we can get everybody together in all our different communities and, you know, maybe take a day a week or a day a month out of our time to gather and talk about what would we do if just such an emergency occurred. How could we survive? A guy like myself, you know, I think I could be helpful because I could actually, repair electrical deals, get things going to keep the lights on, and I know all different types of, things for alternative energy, so I think I could be useful in somebody's group like that. But, you know, you may be just as useful or more. You might have the missing piece of the puzzle that I don't, and all of us together, we got all this. We could build an infrastructure before the infrastructure ever even collapsed, that if anything ever did happen, we'd shake it off. It wouldn't be nothing. We keep on going about our daily lives and enjoying lives. We don't have to get panic stricken and, you know, start stockpiling things because everything has a doggone expiration. You know, things just don't, they don't last very long. Nature starts to deteriorate things. So we got ways where we can extend the life of how long things last. But what's it gonna matter if you got tons and tons of rice and it all gets moldy or bugs in it? You see what I'm saying? So common sense. But we could build infrastructures where even when all heck broke loose, we'd still be able to grow things. We'd still be able to raise fish and stuff. We have the knowledge. We have the technology now. But if we're knocked back into the Stone Age, it'll take a long time for us to try to figure it all out again. Let's keep going here.
There's this little guard shack, chain link fence, and then this set of concrete bunker doors beyond. This wasn't on a map. It wasn't found in government records. So the reporter started digging, and he turned up some fascinating information about some of those bunkers. The most famous, Raven Rock. Situated close to Camp David on the Maryland-Pennsylvania line, Raven Rock has been renovated recently, and it's ready to go at a moment's notice. It operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every single day of the year. Graf explained to NPR, Raven Rock is inside a hollowed-out mountain, a freestanding city inside, made up of individual, three-story buildings. It has a fire department, police department, medical facilities, even a dining hall that serves 4 meals a day. After 9/11, Raven Rock was dramatically expanded, and today, it could hold as many as 5,000 people. For the overflow, more facilities are hidden around the country, some known, some secret.
I caught up with Garrett Graf to get even more details on the government's secret plans. Some of it's cool. Some of it, honestly, is scary.
This is the history of the government's Cold War doomsday plans, sort of everything that would have happened during and after a nuclear attack, and the secret plans for how the U.S. government would rebuild afterwards. And while the book focuses a lot on the Cold War, these plans are all still now in effect. These are the same plans that would guide us if we ended up in a war with North Korea or with Russia today. So there is this whole network of bunkers around Washington, including one of the largest. It is Raven Rock, the title of the book, which is the mountain bunker in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, just over the state line from Camp David, the president's weekend retreat. And Raven Rock and Mount Weather, which is the civilian government bunker in Berryville, Virginia, are literally hollowed out mountains with small cities built inside, where the U.S. government would retreat in the event of an evacuation of Washington or a surprise attack. We have this whole network of helicopters and planes that would drop in, evacuate officials from across Washington, and evacuate them out to the mountains in these bunkers and dozens of others like them scattered around the rest of the United States.
Who would get in and who, we'd be sitting here today still, doesn't matter, but certain people that you might think would get in probably won't.
So one of the interesting aspects of this book is understanding just how tightly classified these plans are. We know that they include the cabinet secretaries, the leadership of Congress, people like the Supreme Court, the leaders of top government agencies, but even people working side by side in the same offices may not understand who is going to be saved in the event of an evacuation and who isn't.
For instance, would a cabinet secretary's wife or husband get to go?
No, and this is one of the great tensions of these plans dating all the way back to the literal first government evacuation drill in the summer of 1954, when Dwight Eisenhower evacuates to that Mount Weather bunker with his cabinet, and they bring along all of their secretaries, their assistants, but none of the wives. And the wives have this very chilly game of cards back in Washington as they realize that none of their husbands were going to bring them along in the event of nuclear war.
Who works there? Because I would imagine it's a whole industry in these small towns of people and family and friends who keep these up and running.
Yeah, so these bunkers, Raven Rock, Mount Weather, others around the country, are staffed 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Some of them are Pentagon facilities, Defense Department facilities.
I don't know if you missed that, but there was a section there where he was talking about how husbands weren't going to bring their wives do a nuclear, survival deal. So, could you imagine being a part of the government and your government says, well, you're welcome to show up, but you can't bring your family with you. There ain't enough room. What kind of man would leave his family behind? Seriously. But these are the kind of mentalities, you know, they only want to take who they believe to be beneficial, and if you're not beneficial, you're not going. Period. That's why I think that all humanity is beneficial, and so I think we ought to try to save everyone. And we'd be the ones that are actually doing the saving. We'd be the ones that actually make the plan, so to speak. But anyway, let's keep on rolling here.
And some of them are actually run by FEMA, which is the civilian agency that's in charge of responding to an emergency. In fact, there is right now, as we are sitting here talking, a presidential doomsday plane, the National Airborne Command Post, which is where the president would run nuclear war from the sky, is sitting on a runway in Omaha, Nebraska. It is fully staffed. Its engines are running. It is ready to take off with just 12 to 15 minutes worth of notice and meet up with the president, rendezvous with the president wherever he is, and let him run nuclear war from the sky for 3 days.
That is incredible. And I was reading in your book there, these cards, and we don't know exactly how many are out there, right? But they have driving directions on the back in case, you know, you're caught unawares and you're the Secretary of Agriculture. You just pull out your card and it tells you where to go?
Yeah, so these plans, there are a certain level of officials who will be evacuated by helicopter wherever they are. There's a team of helicopters in Washington. You can see them every day in the skies over Washington, these blue and gold Air Force helicopters that are basically up there practicing for doomsday on a daily basis. Those helicopters would swoop in and evacuate from pre-designated landing zones all of the top leadership of the government, everyone from the top law enforcement officials to the top cabinet secretaries. But then there's a much larger set of these individuals, sort of the government managers, specialists, meteorologists, logistics and supply personnel, as many as 10,000 people in Washington who have special driving directions and special evacuation directions to make their way to these bunkers and relocation facilities around Washington if something happens, whether it's a terrorist attack, whether it's a chemical attack, biological, or nuclear war. What we have seen through history is that these plans have never worked as intended. On September 11th, which is the only time that these plans were fully activated in U.S. history, they certainly didn't come anywhere close to working as well as they could be, as they had been expected to. And I think what's interesting at this moment is when I started writing this book 5 years ago, this stuff, you know, the threat of Russia, the threat of nuclear war, the threat of doomsday, all seemed like ancient history, you know, the old days of the Cold War.
So, you know, during that time, during the Cold War, they built all kinds of bunkers all over the place. Even citizens were actually building bunkers. You know, a lot of times people will find old bunkers that maybe their grandfathers or somebody built. And so, you know, it's not like it couldn't be done, but like it was mentioned in the chat room over there, People for People, not everybody's got money, you know. Nobody can afford their own place. Troy said that, you know. But together, combined, you and your people in your community could actually pull your resources and build something. You see what I'm saying here? Sorry, I'm having a bit of issue right there. Anyway, I'm going to keep on playing this. I'm going to skip back up to the top here and start off with a different one real quick. Because I want you to hear something. Alright, there it is, I think. We're going to start with this one.
This video was made possible by Hover. Get 10% off your custom domain or email from Hover at hover.com/Wendover. When nuclear bombs obliterate the Earth, or a virus wipes out the human race, or robots push mankind out of existence, the U.S. government believes that democracy should continue on. The country believes that, even if the population of the U.S. ceases to exist, the country should go on. Akin to its almost paranoid nature, the U.S. government has a series of defined protocols on how to continue the country when the country is no longer. The continuity.
Alright, I gotta pause this for a second before he starts talking about continuity of government. But the whole doggone thing is, if you listen really closely to the terminology being used, he said that the government believes that democracy should, continue on. Well, democracy is essentially mob rule. And so that gives you a big, powerful government because whatever the mob wants, that's what happens. It all depends on who owns the mob. Anyway, here in the United States, at least, we're a representative republic, which gives the government less power over us than what we, you know, what actually goes on. That's all for another show.
...of government plans. You probably already know about part of these plans because you probably know about the U.S. president's line of succession. If the president dies, there's a list of 17 people, ranging all the way from the vice president down to the Secretary of Homeland Security, who would take their place. With such a long list, the chances of the U.S. going without a president are near none. The one time a year when the entire line gathers together, the State of the Union, one individual in the line of succession is appointed designated survivor to wait out in a bunker to run the government if the rest of it dies. But the line of succession is the basic stuff, the stuff people already know. What's far less known is the semi-secret protocols and places the government has spent billions of dollars and decades building. However, until just 60 or 70 years ago, the U.S. felt it was untouchable. At no time in history had an enemy existed as relatively close to the U.S. as during the Cold War. The U.S.'s foreign policy always kept in mind that an ocean separated it from its enemies, but with the invention of nuclear bombs, an enemy could go from declaring war on the U.S. to toppling its government in a matter of hours. During these days, the U.S. government began actively preparing for doomsday. There are four main bunkers from which the U.S. government would run the country following a world-ending event. The Presidential Emergency Operations Center, Raven Rock Mountain Complex, Mount Weather Emergency Operations Center, and the Cheyenne Mountain Complex. The president is the most important person to survive Doomsday, both for symbolic and logistical reasons. If a nuclear warhead is inbound to Washington, he or she would most likely evacuate downstairs from the White House into their underground bunker, but that's not guaranteed. During the Truman administration, the president refused to leave the Oval Office during what was believed to be an attack. This ended up being a false alarm, but some presidents have said that they believe that they should ride out an attack with the rest of the population. It's just like saying a captain should go down with their ship. The Oval Office, and even the White House bunker, is not the safest place someone can be during an attack. But morale saves lives, and seeing a president braving out the fight can help create a sense of national unity that would keep the country together. A single person is replaceable, but the government as a whole is more delicate. Raven Rock, Pennsylvania would serve as the underground Pentagon. All the leaders of the armed forces would evacuate by helicopter to this facility in the event of an attack and command their troops across the country and the world. During an attack of an apocalyptic scale, it's likely that martial law would be imposed, meaning that the military would take over day-to-day control of the country. The commanders would have wide-ranging, almost dictatorial powers, and habeas corpus would be revoked. From distributing food to serving as law enforcement to keeping the lights on, the armed forces would truly work on the front lines of rebuilding a destroyed country. The Cheyenne Mountain Complex just out of Colorado Springs, Colorado, would serve as the home to NORAD, the agency responsible for controlling and tracking the skies above the US and Canada. So, if the above-ground world proved too dangerous for the country's leadership, these four underground bunkers would serve as the home to the bare bones of the U.S. government. But what about the rest of it? Nearly 4.5 million people are employed by the U.S. federal government, and they all work to keep it running. Where would the hundreds of government agencies go? Well, nobody knows exactly, at least publicly, but we do know how they would relocate. You might have heard of the DEFCON system. It makes frequent appearances in movies, but few have heard of COGCON. COGCON is a readiness level system that directs agencies how to prepare for the activation of the government's continuity of government plans. At COGCON 4, the lowest level, every U.S. government agency must be able to relocate to an alternate facility and perform basic functions within 12 hours. It's an incredibly ambitious plan. At COGCON 3, this number goes down to 8 hours, then at COGCON 2 is when things get real. At this level, doomsday is imminent. Every agency has three sites for their continuity plan, A, B, and C, and their agency would split into three corresponding teams, A, B, and C. The A team would relocate to a secure facility near its normal headquarters, probably bunkers under DC. The B team would relocate near the Mount Weather facility, and the C team would relocate to another undisclosed facility. Each team would be ready to take over operations at a moment's notice. The A team would continue operations for as long as possible, either until they're dead or communications are cut off. Then the B team would seamlessly take over operations. If the B team falls, the C team would serve as the final chance for the survival of the government agency. When the surface of the Earth is unsurvivable, there is one other place to go other than underground, to the sky. The traditional Air Force One has redundancy upon redundancy and most likely dozens of classified defense measures, but there's a different plane from which the president might command the country after doomsday, the Boeing E-4 Advanced Airborne Command Post. It became increasingly clear to leadership under the Carter administration that the bunkers would do little to protect against a direct nuclear strike. In fact, they would just concentrate the very individuals that the enemy would attack into a few holes in mountains. Surviving a nuclear blast while 7 miles above Earth, however, is far more conceivable. This plane is sometimes referred to as Air Force One when it matters. Whenever the president travels, one of these planes is stationed at most a couple hundred miles away. From this plane, the president can command the country indefinitely. It can be refueled mid-air by tanker, so, barring technical issues, it can remain flying for as long as the food and water lasts. In a doomsday scenario, this plane could literally stay airborne for weeks at a time to keep the country's leadership safe. After Armageddon, the United States' goal would be to rebuild the ailing country with however many survivors remained. But how would the country continue as the same country when most everyone was dead? Because of the line of succession, the president could be an unknown, unelected official with a bare-bones government of just a few thousand people. So what's to say to a survivor in Texas or Oregon or Alaska that it's still the same country continuing on? Well, what binds America together is a common culture and legacy. Art and historical artifacts are the physical representations of this, and their survival would pose a powerful message about the state of the Union. On Doomsday, resources would be scarce and disjointed, so officials have had to make decisions about which items to save and which would be left behind. For example, priority would be given to Leonardo da Vinci's Ginevra da Vinci over Rogier van der Weyden's St. George and the Dragon, and the Declaration of Independence would be saved before the Constitution. Ideally, though, all three of the nation's most important documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, would be evacuated from Washington. Grouped together, they would be called Freedom Documents Group 1, and while some high-level officials would evacuate Washington by road, these three documents would get their own helicopter straight to Mount Weather to continue the powerful legacy of the United States. Nobody knows exactly how or if the U.S. government will survive Doomsday. All we know are some of the plans. Plans are just plans, though, and do not account for the unknown. In the event that the United States is truly threatened by nuclear war, pandemic, or any other world-ending event, who knows if the population will even believe that they are still in the United States? Little distinguishes one country from another other than what people think. And if people believe they are part of the country of Alaska or the Kingdom of California, then for the most part, they are. If the principles of separation of power, judicial review, checks and balances, limited government, federalism, and popular sovereignty live on past the end, the continuity of government plans have succeeded, even if the members of government die. These plans are not about saving the president or the secretary of defense or any one person. They're about making sure the structure of democratic government continues on through thick and thin.
So, democratic government through thick and thin. Well, we can talk about all that later, but you know, the whole crazy thing is when you get down to the actual price tag of what the government has been doing, you know, secret projects such as underground bunkers, and you know, you hear all the different conspiracy theories about under the Denver airport and all this kind of stuff. So they're building cities underneath the ground for just such an emergency that some sort of situation happens where it's not livable above the ground. And my thing is, while we're all sitting out here trying to live our lives, and you know, we've very few of us got enough resources by ourselves to do anything, why aren't we gathering in masses with our communities and actually building community shelters in our communities for just such an emergency? We have a plan. Because it's blatantly obvious all the money we spent paying the government to take care of things, they're basically taking care of their own best interest. And so why aren't we? Why aren't we building our houses if we live in tornado alleys? Why aren't we building our houses with geometrical structures that will withstand really extremely high winds and even things flying through the air that could be deflected off, you know, that kind of thing? It begs the question, you know. It would be so easy for us to get knocked back into the Stone Age, but if we the people don't want to, ride the storm out, and if we are lucky to survive, end up on the other side with some sort of government coming out of there, out of the side of the mountain and saying, "Hey, well, we're back. What? You made a mess the first time. Now you're back? Really?" That don't sound like a good idea to me. I think that the better idea is that we the people actually start thinking about possibilities and working together and building our infrastructure to the extent that no matter what happens, there ain't no power outages. Power outages is something that just don't happen anymore unless for some reason somebody doesn't do some maintenance and something breaks down and we have to take the time to fix it. But even to that extent, we could build redundancy systems like they did on the you know, the presidential planes and stuff. We could build it. We could do it. Heck, most of you probably got jobs where you're building parts for it anyway. You know, all the jobs that you're doing out there, you got the skills. You got the technology. And imagine if you you find a piece of land and you get to you get your little township together and you say, hey, look, we got this center piece of land here, and we want to plan for just such an emergency that you know, something goes awry, that we can put all our families in here and be able to you know, survive. So even if you only had a population of 300 in your town, you could plan for a building that would withstand 600 people, you know, and start to prepare that. We don't know if any kind of doomsday is going to go on, but if you're still building houses like they were back in the 1800s, then you still have a house that can get blown over or essentially rot because of you know, what's going on in the environment. And if you live near a floodplain where it's a possibility that you could flood, then you could actually build your houses to not only withstand the wind, but withstand the water as well. Withstand fire, withstand radiation from space, withstand a nuclear blast for that matter. But it has to be a decision in your community where you really seriously want your community to survive and all your families to have, you know, their own version of a golden ticket. You don't see the government saying, hey, look, we're going to give you all some money, and what's your money anyway? We're going to give you all some money, and we want you to build a storm shelter or a bunker in your backyard so that just in case, that way you can survive too. You know, not all of you survive. Somebody might get a direct hit from whatever's coming at us, but, you know, at least it gives you a chance. What chance do you got now? You're left out in the cold. You're not invited to the party. You're not invited to the elite doomsday bunker. You're not part of the continuity of government. Why is the average Joe always getting the shaft? That's the crazy thing. Why is it the average Joe does all the hard work, and then when doomsday comes around or the zombie apocalypse, you're left to your own devices? You got people out there that want to disarm you. All right, so let's say hypothetically they get to do that. They get gun control and they get you completely disarmed. Then along comes a zombie apocalypse or alien invasion or, you know, a war from a not friendly neighbor or whatever. You can't defend yourself. So they took away your defense. It took away your money. It took away your, livelihood. It took away everything that it is necessary for you to survive. You don't have the infrastructure you had before because something tore it down, some terrorist or some idiot, or the government itself. And so now you got to rely on whatever primitive knowledge you got in your head on how to forage in the in your neighborhood for food or whatever. At the same time, we'll happen to worry about some jerks that didn't want to prepare come around and steal stuff from you. So that gun control kind of thing, it sounds like really good, don't it? It sounds like a good plan. Yeah, take away all your defense mechanisms, and just in case some emergency happens, you can always trust your government, right? Okay, yeah, well, they're up in the bunker, you're not. So now what? You know what? I hope you're understanding what I'm telling you. They don't care about you. And if they did, then everyone would have a bunker. You know? That's what it'd be like. If they did, then everyone would be encouraged. Let's keep going here.
The President's Doomsday Plane. There's no denying that the US is the most powerful nation in the world with the most powerful government. And there's no surprise that when things get bad, they are going to have a plan in place to get their key people out of harm's way. To do this, the US has a fleet of four planes known as Doomsday Planes, codenamed E-4B. They are converted 747s that are radiation protected, flying presidential offices, that have three decks and are capable of carrying up to 112 people, which would include the US President, Secretary of Defense, and a handful of other key government personnel. In the event of a meteor strike, a nuclear war, a mass terrorist attack, or even an apocalypse, the planes can be scrambled immediately and can stay in the air for days without refueling, with the sole purpose of keeping the US government running whilst in the air. It's a pretty incredible operation because no matter where the president travels outside of North America in Air Force One, which is his regular presidential plane, one of four Doomsday 747s isn't far behind and is always waiting at the nearby airport just in case. The planes have...
And they keep them running. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. These things are running. Just for just such an emergency that something happens. So think about all that wasted fuel. Think about all the manpower to keep this thing going. Think about the money that it costs to just build this thing. This doomsday plane that can survive radiation and stay in the air for weeks at a time. Think about that. They already pre-planned for everything with a redundancy and a backup for a backup and a backup. And I'm asking, why don't the average Joe do that?
Have 67 antenna and satellite dishes, as well as an EMP and thermal radiation shield. They even have a 5-mile cable that can be dropped from the plane in order to communicate with submerged submarines. But despite us knowing a little about the onboard equipment, and there being a few pictures and videos around, many think the full specs would be highly confidential and classified, and that the photos and videos are of an older, outdated plane. So how did all this even come about? Well, it was the brainchild of President Ronald Reagan, who commissioned the Doomsday planes near the end of the Cold War, when tensions were running high and there was a genuine threat of a nuclear attack. After this, the US authorities didn't talk much about them, but in 2001, they became the highlight of a worldwide mystery. On the morning of September the 11th, 2001, many people, including military and government officials, witnessed a plane flying above the White House in Washington, which is a restricted airspace just before the Pentagon was hit. No one has said what the plane was doing, and there is no mention of it in the 9/11 Commission's report. To this day, even military officials say they do not know what plane it was, but looking at the videos and pictures of it flying around, it looks like the Doomsday plane. But since it was airborne before President Bush had a chance to board it, it's almost certain that he was not on it. So who was, and why was it flying? It's still a mystery. In more recent years, Russian President Vladimir Putin has commissioned his own Doomsday plane, designed to maintain full control over Russia's armed forces in the event of a nuclear attack. And it's believed many other countries want, or already have, their own planes, ready to protect their most powerful people in the event of a world crisis. We all talk about NASA discovering alien life or being visited by them, and it may have already happened, but the question is there a protocol in place for meeting with aliens or if they decide to invade Earth? It sounds a bit far-fetched, but it's something that the US government has considered, and although it's something that they do not regard as a serious threat to national security, there is still a plan in place. As far as we are aware, the plan is not currently funded by the government and hasn't been since the early 1990s. But there is a non-governmental organization set up by the International Academy of Astronautics. In their own words, it's to prepare, reflect on, manage, advise, and consult in preparation for a putative signal of extraterrestrial intelligence origin. And should anything be detected that indicates we are not alone, then the SETI, which is funded by the government, would be notified so they can carry out their own research, and if need be, make a national announcement. That is the official protocol released to the public of what would happen. However, it's believed that the Pentagon has more classified plans of how to deal with extraterrestrial contact depending on the threat level. For example, violent, peaceful, needy, or helpful. But it's not just the US. Many other countries, including the UK, apparently have plans in place for such a thing. Nick Pope, who was a former advisor for the UK's Ministry of Defence for 21 years, who used to investigate UFO reports to see if there was any evidence of a threat, claims that the country has a host of weapons to defend the world against an alien invasion. He said that although the government's position is that there is no significant defense threat, we simply do not know, meaning we would be silly not to have a plan in place for such a thing. Stephen Hawking has said that if aliens did come to Earth, they would no doubt be far more advanced than us and would be looking to conquer and colonize whatever planets they could reach. This is one that, although we may love to meet aliens, and may already have, we cannot instantly assume they would be as hostile and friendly as we would like them to be. And it seems the government and NASA are fully aware of this. What if a massive meteorite hit Earth today? In truth, it would only need to be a mile wide to cause some seriously bad damage. The energy it would generate would be equal to a 1 million megaton bomb, so it's very unlikely any of us would survive. Take the asteroid 1997 XF-11 for example. It's predicted that in 2028 it will come very close to Earth, and although it's expected to miss the planet, if it does alter its path, then it would be on course for destruction. So what do we have in place to protect us from such a thing? Thankfully, NASA are on the case. They have a Planetary Defense Coordination Office whose sole purpose is to ensure the early detection of potentially hazardous objects. These include asteroids and comets that are predicted to bring them within 0.05 astronomical units of Earth, which is about 4.6 million miles. Potential threats are constantly tracked, so warnings can be issued if potential hazards are on course for Earth. These are then redirected, depending on the scenario, by a handful of asteroid deflection strategies. To name a few, a rocket motor could be attached to it, driving it onto a new path. A nuclear explosion could be detonated on, above, or behind the hazard, pushing it off course, or a bomb could blow it to pieces. In fact, in early 2016, Russia said they were going to utilize some of their missiles left over from the Cold War to have on hand just in case they needed to blow up asteroids before they became a threat to Earth. However, with all this, and even asteroid 1997 XF-11 being a possible threat in 2028, it's said that hazardous asteroids have a less than 0.1% chance of impacting Earth in the next 100 years. If that statistic was to change, however, it's nice to know that we have enough in place to prevent any serious damage. Nuclear war threat. This one could go two ways. The prevention of a nuclear war, or World War III, which if a nuclear attack took place, would most likely be triggered. Now, before I get started, you should first know that there are 9 countries that have successfully detonated nuclear weapons. Russia, China, France, the UK, the USA, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. Together they have more than 15,000 nuclear weapons, more than enough to destroy every human on Earth, and with around 2,000 of those being on high alert status, meaning they can be launched within a few minutes, what protocols are in place to stop something happening? Now, I thought whilst researching this subject, there would be loads of treaties and agreements between countries to prevent an all-out nuclear war. However, I was shocked to find only one prevention, and that was signed in Washington on June the 22nd, 1973, and was created to reduce the chance of a nuclear war between the United States and the then USSR. The two countries agree to minimize the threat of a war and agree on a policy to restrain hostility. Both parties agreed that if there is a danger of a nuclear confrontation between them or any other country, they are committed to consulting with each other in order to avoid this risk. But that's pretty much the only formal prevention protection in place. Of course, if one country did go crazy and launch a nuclear attack, I'm sure the most powerful countries would come together and try their best to prevent an all-out war. But, to put it simply, there isn't a disclosed Plan B. It's long been said that a nuclear war cannot be won and could signal the destruction of civilization, making parts or all of Earth uninhabitable. And with the ongoing threat of terrorists being able to access nuclear weapons and nuclear dangers on the rise, it would be nice to think that there was a more robust plan in place, but it seems there isn't. At least if there is, it hasn't been made public. Now, I'd like to think there is a highly confidential plan in case of an attack, and I'm sure there is, but for now, we can all be thankful that a nuclear attack is said to be a very unlikely worst-case scenario. The Pentagon Zombie Apocalypse Training. It started in 2014 when an extraordinary guide was uncovered that gives details of how to survive a zombie apocalypse. The unclassified document dated the 30th of April 2011 and called CONOP-8888 details contingency plans for an onslaught and how to preserve the sanctity of human life among all the non-zombie humans. This is no made-up hoax either, it's a genuine 50-plus page report that talks about everything you could expect. Now, I can't read the whole thing out, but it talks about how to kill a zombie by destroying the brain and then burning the body, how to deal with a zombie outbreak in various different places, and the different type of zombies. It also says that after being infected, a human will turn into a zombie within 30 to 40 days, and talks about chicken zombies, which sound crazy, but there is a source link at the bottom of the Pentagon report of this actually happening. The link page talks about old hens that have been euthanized by farmers with carbon monoxide, that have been buried and then clawed their way back to the surface. It's really an interesting read for any zombie fans, and you forget that the people at the Pentagon, the headquarters of the United States Department of Defense, are the ones who wrote it. So why did they spend the time to do this? The official explanation for this document is that it's a training tool used in an in-house training exercise, where students learn about the basic concepts of military plans and order development through a fictional training scenario, which makes it less boring and easier to take in the information. Of course, some people believe that it's a cover-up and the government are preparing for a zombie outbreak, and if they are, then they're not alone. Apparently, Britain also has a plan, set up in response to a worried member of the public, although the Ministry of Defense denies this claim, leaving us in the dark, until of course, when the time comes where some chemical or disease starts infecting the world. I will finish this off with the final words in the Pentagon report. Every human that becomes a zombie increases the enemy's numbers and decreases the chances that healthy humans will survive.
So, we talked about zombies, aliens, nuclear war, rocks from space, and all kinds of craziness. So, these are all the things that governments plan for, and even doomsday preppers, and even other people that aren't necessarily doomsday preppers, but they're survivalists that basically plan on going out into the woods and living off the land. Well, if there ain't no land to live off of, I don't know what you're going to do. But, you know, hey, to each his own. Anyway, I think that with the technology and the knowledge that we have available, we could put in infrastructures that would ensure that no matter whether or not it was not survivable outside, at least we'd have, you know, like hydroponics and aquaponics and all the different types of ways to grow food and vegetables and stuff like that. You know, all everything, fish. But it's never going to happen unless you can somehow or another get a wave of ideas, mindset in the general public that say, hey, you know, we're going to get screwed if anything major happens because the government has a plan and we're not part of it. We're outside the gate. You know, we don't have the golden ticket or the little ID card with directions on how to get to the bunker. That kind of deal. So, I'm into trying to save as many people as possible. The government is going to save whoever's the most useful. And I think we're all useful. Anyway, let's keep going here.
Hi folks, Canadian Prepper here. So today I want to talk about how not to be perceived and how not to actually be a crazy doomsday prepper. Let's get to it. One of the things that keeps me motivated to do this is my goal of reducing the stigma and bringing more sensibility to the realm of macro preparedness. Now, I'm not talking about a 3-day power outage. Clearly, anybody who watches this channel with frequency is preparing for a lot worse than that. Do I believe it's probable that something like that could happen? Abso-frickin-lutely I do. Put it this way, never before in history has everything been so right, but never before in history has there been a possibility of so many different things going wrong. Which, of course, is owed to our complete and total dependence on technology to keep everybody alive. The different scenarios we discuss when we talk about the grid going down for a prolonged period of time leading to mass amounts of death and suffering, these are things that are absolutely plausible, they are quite probable, and in many people's predictions, they are quite likely. Now, I hope they never come to pass. One of the number one rules to not being perceived as a crazy prepper is firstly not romanticizing SHTF. SHTF would be an absolute hell that I hope never comes to pass. I hope I can keep doing this for 10 years and nothing bad will ever happen. Because it would be absolute hell. Sometimes I look at, you know, the increased production value of my videos, and I don't feel that I'm doing the grittiness of what we talk about on this channel justice. Because this is serious stuff. We're talking about millions, potentially billions of casualties in some instances. So this is very, very serious. And you absolutely should not be glamorizing, glorifying, or looking forward in any way, shape, or form to an SHTF scenario just to give your life meaning. Now, rule number two, and this should probably be rule number one, take care of yourself. I mean, how can you expect anybody to take what you have to say seriously? Not that you should be proselytizing to people. Did I pronounce that right? Proselytizing. Anyways, not that you should be preaching to people that, hey, you should go and be a prepper. Most people who know me, I don't even talk about this with them. Because unless it comes up in conversation, then sure. But you're never going to catch me out there on the street corner with a bullhorn telling people they need to prepare for the end of the world. Be sensible with these things, but take care of yourself physically, psychologically. Build yourself up. Go to school. Educate yourself. Be a part of the system. That is number two. Be a productive member of society. Don't just, you know, sit back and shortchange yourself in this world of things, waiting for crap to hit the fan so you can be the hero and slay all the dragons. That's no way to live. You know, I mean, do you want to die knowing that all you did was hoard a bunch of supplies waiting for something to happen that never happened? Which may, of course, happen, but let's hope it doesn't happen. You don't want to be that person. You want to make contributions to society. So invest in your children. Invest in yourself. Build things for society. Be a part, be a fully functioning member of society. Have a number, go out and do things and live your life and help people. Number three is have all the facts of what you're talking about. You know, sometimes I set goals for myself to make certain videos, and I put deadlines on myself. I want to make this video by such and such a time. Well, I don't always do enough research, even though I do a lot of research for these videos, and I want to make a video on what research actually is. Because research, you got to be careful with research, because there's this thing called the confirmation bias. We tend to go and seek out things which just affirm the conclusions that we've already told ourselves are true. All I'm saying is make sure you have the facts. It's okay to entertain alternative viewpoints. In fact, I would strongly encourage you to entertain all ideas. That doesn't mean that just because you come across an alternative viewpoint that you automatically need to defend it to the death in all caps. Let's not get started on all caps. And you absolutely need to be aware that if you're going down the YouTube rabbit hole, you are in a virtual bubble. You are in an echo chamber. The more you search for something on YouTube, the more it recommends that sort of information for you. So if you are having a debate with someone and you're only researching certain things on the internet, be they political, religious, scientific, what have you, that agree with what you're saying, then you're just going to get more of the same. And you're going to think that that's all that's out there. I mean, all it takes is a few searches of the counterpoint, and you're going to get a whole different barrage of suggested videos, which are probably going to challenge a lot of your perspectives. And I'm dead serious about this. This is why I try to keep my political, religious, and scientific views of things open, because I want to hear both sides of the debate. Oftentimes, when you come across alternative or fringe ideas, they're packaged in such a way that make you feel like you're getting some esoteric information, that the information can only be had by somebody with special critical thinking capabilities. Just beware that you may be being taken for a ride. And just because something is mainstream doesn't mean it's untrue. In fact, sometimes the mainstream media will promote something, but they just won't tell you the whole truth about it. So there's two ways that you can be deceived. One of the ways is that they deny what's happening or they don't tell you what's happening. Another way would be that they're not telling you the full extent of what has happened. Another thing is, don't just prep for one thing. You remember the show Doomsday Preppers? So you remember how each one of the participants had to basically say that they were prepping for one particular thing or one thing that they felt was most probable? You don't have to be like that. You can have a broad spectrum of preparedness. That's why I talk about all the potential national, regional, global disasters on this channel, because you have to be prepared for everything, because everything has a probability of happening. So don't pigeonhole yourself as a certain type of prepper, even a certain politic of prepper. I mean, I know I can't tell people not to believe certain things, so I'm not even going to try to do that. All I would ask is that try to see the benefit in being moderate, at least on some issues. You know, if there was one person I would in some way like to emulate, and I don't mean I want to copy or I want to be this person, or I think I even have the capability to do what this person does, but I think that Joe Rogan is the closest thing we got right now to somebody who's trying to get all the parties to the table and have a level-headed discussion about things. And that's what I would kind of like to do for preparedness. Like I say, I'm not saying I'm on that level. I'm not even saying I fully agree with everything the guy says. But I do think he's genuinely trying to balance all the opinions and keep everybody happy and keep everybody from basically killing each other. I mean, he had the Twitter CEO on. He had Alex Jones on. Who else is doing that? Anyways, this is not a pitch for Joe Rogan. I'm just saying that's the kind of person I aspire to be. I want to hear all sides of the perspective. But if I can deduce that your perspective is mostly bullshit after I go and get the facts, I'm not going to give that a platform. Now, another thing is staying organized. The only difference between macro preparedness and hoarding is organization. You can get as much stuff accumulated, non-perishable goods, ammunition, first aid equipment, water supplies, water treatment supplies, I should say, as long as it's organized and as long as it's not totally infringing on the rest of your life, then there's nothing wrong with that from a psychiatric perspective. It's arguable there's nothing wrong with that, period, because if you're not well adapted to the society around you, then no matter how maladaptive that society is on the whole, you will by definition be deemed as crazy in comparison to that. Anyways, stay organized, keep on top of things, know what you have, use what you have regularly in the field. Don't just go and buy stuff and put it away and never use it. Actually go out and use the stuff. The next thing is, you gotta live your life, because it defeats the purpose. I've always said that people shouldn't live to prep. You should prep to live. It's all about having experiences. It's not about waiting for the perfect opportunity to do something. It's just about taking a gamble, living life. Sometimes you're going to have to take risks. So go and take some risks. You may be depriving yourself of an experience which is going to take you to the next level in your personal development if you are too much of an isolated shut-in. So don't deprive yourself of the wider world of things by being overly obsessed. It's okay to laugh. It's okay to sing. It's okay to dance. It's okay to have fun once in a while. Anyways, if you can do all these things, if you can keep a level head, and by all means, continue to educate yourself. It's very hard to call somebody crazy when they are very informed, when they're very intelligent. So keep educating yourself about the myriad of things the world has to offer. I'm going to be doing a video soon which talks about the utopian view versus the dystopian view, and you can imagine which view as preppers we tend to espouse, and there's a good reason for that that I'm going to talk about. So stay tuned for that. Let me know what you think in the comments section. Thanks for watching. Thanks for all the support. Don't forget, there's 15% off the store right now. I believe it's running until April 7th, possibly? 15% off the entire store. So go check it out. Just my gift to you, and that's only being advertised to previous customers to the store and to my viewers here on YouTube. So thanks again for...
All right, so, you know, there are some preppers out there that basically make a lot of money on selling people stuff, which I ain't got no problem with people making money, but the whole thing is, look, if everything was to go awry and you're a doomsday prepper and you already got your stuff all together, there's a good possibility that the area that you're in is probably not the one you're going to want to be in, for one. So it'd kind of be a little bit better to have your whole community involved in a scenario to where if all heck broke loose that everybody could sound the alarm and people could go to the community, safe place, bunker or whatever you guys decide to build. And you know, take care of each other. Have everything in place, you know, and you could actually use it for lesser emergencies when, you know, bad weather comes on, everybody has a safe place to go or whatever, or, you know, maybe in order to keep all the supplies fresh, rotate them out every once in a while, help a family out that needs some food or whatever, and so you can constantly keep fresh supplies in there. And, you know, if everybody pitches in their, you know, the resources to make this happen, then your community is secure in that no matter what happens, you're going to be prepared for it. And, you know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility to build an above-ground bunker that would literally float if necessary, and that actually could be locked down and sealed with oxygen and everything else that you'd need as if you were going to be flying through space. So you're building the equivalents of a spaceship, a submarine, a boat or whatever, all into one, planning for every single possible thing that could potentially go wrong, including sickness, you know? And so if your community decided to do that, it wouldn't take up, you know, as much land as you would think it would actually take in order to build something that would, you know, house every single person in your community. For emergency purposes, if necessary, you could build in an infrastructure that would have underground tunnels that would lead people from escape hatches from their house up into the deal. Or even to that extent, having them tethered to the deal so that if worst case scenario, happened, massive flood or something like that, everybody, you know, in the whole town is saved. Except for those who might get caught out, in the middle of nowhere and not be able to make it back in time or something like that. But it's not about living about paranoia. It's about living with the knowledge that there are stupid people in this world. There's crazy events that go on. There's unforeseen events. There's all kinds of things that could happen. But we have the technology right now to ensure that humanity can continue on no matter what happens. But the way that it's set up now, it's only the elitist and the governments and, you know, people who can afford to do things, you know, to be able to build their own personal private bunkers or whatever. But the technology that we have, the knowledge on how to make things float or even fly or, you know, keep the power on, all that kind of stuff, it's all doable. What if you built your school in a different manner, your local school, in a situation that, you know, it was to plan for whatever could potentially go wrong? Your whole entire township or city could actually go to this place, and it's a safe place. You know, we don't think like that though. We think like the government's got it, and whatever happens when it's my time, it's my time. Zombie apocalypse or whatever, you know. But it gives you something to think about when it comes down to, you know, whether or not you want your community to be able to, go on after something major was to happen. You know, we don't think about it like that right now. We got all of our houses have probably got, you know, they got flaws in them. They're not built to their maximum efficiency, which we could actually do. We could build houses to their maximum efficiency. Your own house would become a life pod, you know, where if all heck broke loose, whether the wind picked up, you know, you could have the house where it would literally grab into the ground like a tick and hold on and ride that storm out. You know, it's all doable. Every bit of it's doable. But it ain't going to happen unless people realize that their most valuable resource is their neighbors and their friends and the brilliant people in their own community coming together and planning for such an event. The government's already got it done. They got theirs. You just don't have a ticket. You're not going. You know, you're not one of the ones that's vital to the national security, so to speak. Now, this next one that I'm getting ready to play right here is one about Sweden. And for whatever people like to think about Sweden, I'm pretty impressed with the way that the government inspires people to want to be prepared for any such emergency, including invasion, you know? So, let's listen to this one right here.
Tonight on Dateline, one of the world's most peaceful countries preparing for the worst.
So these are all canned goods. They have like a quarter of a ton of rice, 42 kilos of ravioli.
What are they prepping for?
Terrorist attack, school shooting, war.
Really?
Yeah, like Russia.
Russia.
Come here and shoot us.
And could their fears be more real than we think?
You can't depend on the government to bring you food or get you water. You have to do it yourself.
This water is very clear and you can drink it.
It's the old Cold War all over again. In Sweden, they say only dead fish follow the stream. It's a warning against mindlessly copying others, and one small reason why in the quiet town of Växjö, this house looks a little different.
Jag skulle säga, kommer ni ihåg när vi hade den här brandövningen? Mm. Kommer ni ihåg var brandsläckarna finns?
Nej, men det är väl i Västerjämt sen här i Trappan.
48-year-old Lotta Delanius is a nurse and single mum who wants her family to be prepared.
Och sen måste ni, det är första man ni måste göra.
Ja.
Alarma, släcka.
Ja.
Mm. Kolla så att ingen är inne i huset.
Mm.
Kan du få ut katten också kanske?
Ja, men det är ju förut av sist.
She's part of a growing movement of Swedes who call themselves preppers.
I've been prepping for about 4 years. A prepper is one who takes care of themselves and makes sure that we can survive if some crisis comes. You need light. You need to prepare your meals.
Lotta isn't just preparing for blackouts or storms.
You got a knife, scissors.
She's also preparing for armed conflict. And her readiness is supported by the government.
And we also have this, of course, which contains all the vital information that you need to know.
What does it say on the front there, Lotta?
It says, if the crisis or war is coming. Really, because it's what it's about. It tells you what you need to prepare, how much food you need to have at home, why do you have to be a prepper, essentially. This came last year, I think, to everyone, every household in Sweden. Really good.
Preppers are often viewed as God-fearing outliers, predicting the end of the world. But in this Nordic nation, a neighbouring threat is helping the movement go mainstream.
I can see that the Russian threat has increased the last few years. Just look at Ukraine, which is a European country who has been invaded. There's a game going on, who's going to threat who. So yeah, we have to be on the lookout and be prepared.
Och nu ska vi prata om spioneri, för igår så meddelade Säpo att Ryssland är det land som fortfarande spionerar allra mest på Sverige.
Swedes have been bombarded by news about Moscow since Russia occupied eastern Ukraine in 2014.
På internationellt vatten, 6 mil söder om Karlskrona, ska den ryska marinen hålla robotskjutningar nästa vecka.
from suspicious submarines.
Barn och ungdomar som var på seglarläger i närheten filmade de här sekvenserna. Experter som TV4-nyheterna har pratat med bedömer att det som syns på bilderna sannolikt är en ubåt.
The planes in its airspace.
Jaktflygplanet ut från Kaliningrad och kommer i hög fart. De passerar oss ganska långt bort, men ändå närmare än vad som är brukligt. Svänger runt och passerar oss ännu en gång då i vad vi bedömer som är utfart.
Russian military activity has Sweden spooked.
Vitvalar är populära turistattraktioner, men kan de också vara tränade spioner? Experter spekulerar nu kring att valen kan ha tränats av den ryska flottan.
But it's more than just a perceived threat. Sweden's own defense research agency has made a shocking announcement.
So, Johan, you recently published a report looking at Russia's military activity. What did it find?
My conclusion was that Russia is preparing its armed forces for a large-scale war. And in the Russian context, that pertains basically to war over a continent.
And so how is that different to, say, their activities over the last 5 or 10 years?
Russia has used its armed forces more selectively. In Donbass, Eastern Ukraine, Crimea, Georgia, and Syria. But these exercises tell a different story. It's the whole military machinery.
And so, Johan, you can really see just how close Russia is to Sweden when you look at this map.
This distance, I think, is about some 300 kilometers across the Baltic Sea. This is actually Kaliningrad, a Russian exclave. The main part of Russia's Baltic fleet for the Baltic Sea is in here.
Reading through hundreds of Kremlin press statements, Johan Norberg has noticed a frightening build-up of Russian military exercises involving troops, tanks and aircrafts on its home turf.
I can see that the number of forces actually participating is picking up. Just imagine 300,000 soldiers, all levels, all branches of services, doing things at the same time for the same purpose. Just to get it all to work is a major challenge.
How serious, then, is the threat of Russia to Sweden's homeland defense and security?
A threat usually entails an intention and a capability. I don't study Russia's political intentions, so what they want to do, I don't know. But I can see the capabilities they build. That is worrying, because they build the capabilities, we don't know exactly when and how and against whom they're going to use it.
This feeling that Sweden is increasingly vulnerable is why many preppers are learning old skills to survive. 6 hours north of her home in Växjö, in the middle of the Swedish wilderness, Lotta is bugging out.
So here is our bug out location. It's a place where you can go if shit hits the fan and is completely off-grid. So this is our second location, and we have a third location as well.
Here, Lotta is testing her ability to stay alive.
So I have just an old broomstick.
Really?
Yep. Cut it off, drill a hole, put a spike and some string, and there you go. So you put around your neck, and if you fall into the water, you can just pull yourself up.
Mm. Why is it so important to know how to improvise as a prepper?
You have to be able to make sure you're safe. And if you can't go to the store to buy stuff, you have to make it yourself.
Getting back to basics is a key part of prepping. To survive out here, Lotta lives by a simple motto: improvise, adapt, overcome.
A lot of skills has gone lost in the recent years. When I grew up, we were always like in the woods, fishing and stuff. Kids nowadays, they stay indoors and they play their online games, and maybe those skills is obsolete when there is no electricity or internet.
She's almost completely self-sufficient, with water from the stream and fish from a frozen lake.
We have to go on the ice where the sun hasn't shined all day. So we'll try to go out here, I think.
I think I'm gonna hang back for a moment here.
It's pretty thick.
Lotta's learning to problem solve because she knows living through a disaster is a completely unscripted experience.
You make prepping look a lot like fun, Lotta, but it actually is quite serious, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it's a more serious side to it. There is a possibility of armed conflict in our area of the world. And the prepping that I do is to make sure that my kids have the things they need if I'm not there to take care of them.
If war was to come, do you trust your government to provide and look after you?
I think they will do what they can, but right now we don't have enough facilities, knowledge or the organization to do that. So right now, no, you have to prep yourself and have all the things that you need. Nothing today.
I'm told one reason preppers feel vulnerable is because an old military strategy once pioneered by Sweden today lies in tatters. Known as total defence, it ensured being prepared was part of the national psyche. You wouldn't know it from the outside, but beneath this street is a giant bomb shelter.
Wow.
Big entrance. So, welcome to the Marievaret shelter. The place has been standing a long time without ventilation, so the air is not as good as it should be.
Yeah, you can really smell the mold down here.
Yes.
Built in the 1950s, these bunkers are relics of the Cold War, when the entire country was prepared for an attack. Enough of them were built to protect the entire Swedish population at the time, around 8 million Swedes.
And how many people is it meant to shelter then?
For the moment, 3,400 people.
3,400 people,
yes,
could fit inside this bunker.
Yes, that's correct.
Här finns hobbylokaler, inte bara för sömnad utan även för fotografering, för måleri och skulptur.
Once state of the art, the government even spruced this bunker in films at the time.
Här finns en förstklassig teaterscen för amatörer.
As a place to live, watch movies, even exercise.
Flickskolan på Mariabergets topp har fått den här vackra gymnastiksalen, förmodligen enastående i världen.
But in the early 2000s, Sweden slashed defense spending. And like much of total defense, these bunkers fell into disrepair.
2010 var Sverige mycket nära en stor katastrof.
Now Sweden's government is bringing total defense back for the first time in more than half a century.
Om ett stort kraftverk hade stoppat, hade detta gett omfattande konsekvenser över hela landet.
Christina Anderson is from a civil emergency agency whose entire job is preparing society for crisis.
Hej, hörni.
Hej.
Hur går det?
Det går bra.
Vad söker du information vid en kris? Fixar ni den eller hur? Var kom ni fram till?
Kommunens hälsa.
We are putting several different questions about what can happen, how can it affect your daily life, and how can you prepare to handle a crisis as good as possible.
Today, she's teaching a generation who've only ever known peace to imagine war.
We are putting more effort into our total defense. That means to the whole society to be prepared to handle a heightened alert or the threat of war. From governmental agencies to local municipalities, but also individuals.
And you actually wrote the booklet that was distributed.
Yeah, well, we distributed this to 4.8 million households in Sweden last year.
This booklet is a pretty scary thing to receive in the mail. Were people afraid when they received it?
Yes, but at the same time, I think that this is important social information that each people living in Sweden need to have.
Okay. And so what have you listed here as your main concerns?
Terrorist attack, school shooting, war, and natural disasters.
War?
Mm. Yes.
Really?
Yeah, like Russia.
Russia?
Come here and shoot us. Don't trust them. Putin and all his members.
The government is hoping this new generation won't just prep, but act.
Yeah.
Jag tar befälet! God morgon, trovärjare!
500 kilometers south of Stockholm, I've been invited to see military training for Sweden's Home Guard. Like Australia's reserves, it's made up entirely of civilian volunteers. Among them is Lotta.
Well, this is one of the yearly exercises for the Home Guard that we do at least twice a year. So we're going to sharpen our will and strength to defend the country.
The Home Guard is half of Sweden's entire defence force, so it relies heavily on these civilians.
Det är kort avstånd, ett jävligt viktigt vapen. Därför är det jäkligt viktigt att det fungerar. Frågan är om man kanske inte ska lägga den extra resursen för att ha en laddare till sin kulsprutepip.
Overseeing their training is Lieutenant Colonel Per Erik, who's witnessed the military diminish over the past 30 years.
The armed forces was quite huge, and then...
I'll pause this just for a second. There's a... something that I'm thinking about in this particular video, where the government's encouraging people to not only be self-contained but to actually make them part of the defense force, and to some extent United States encourages that a little bit, with mostly with our laws and the Constitution the way it was designed or whatever, but not like they're doing here. You would think that if a government wanted to keep their continuity of government, the best way to ensure that you don't have massive chaos whenever everything goes awry would be to encourage the average citizen to want to defend their homeland or whatever. You know, to be prepared for every possible scenario that could potentially come down. But that's not what we see. It's more like a one-sided, I want to keep myself prepared so I can still be in charge when it's all said and done. And those who want to make money, they want to guide the people in whatever direction is going to be the most beneficial for them. And there are those out there that believe that if they can depopulate the world, that they can bring it back with a more manageable number of people, where the government and the companies and the corporations and the bankers remain in charge. So what I've been saying all along was that if the average Joe had that kind of mindset, to where they want to take care of each other and they want to bring their communities and build infrastructures with all the technology that we have access to, you could get this accomplished on a lower budget than you think, and on a lower scale than you think. You could actually combine all your resources. Every single community has some heavy equipment, tractors and bulldozers and things like that, backhoes. And you can bring all these things together, and you can take and bring the best of the best together to, build, basically foundations and stuff that, would support a larger structure that maybe would be something that would be set up so that if it had to float, it could float. And the concrete platform or whatever that it's set on is merely there to either anchor it down or to, you know, well, basically anchor it down unless such an emergency where the water level rises. And you could even have it set up to where if the water level did rise, it would automatically trip a release that would allow this thing to float up, and then cabling, keep it anchored into one spot so that if the water receded, you could bring it right back down to where it was to begin with. These aren't science fiction things. This is all stuff that people have done before on smaller scales, but your communities could actually build, you know, infrastructures that would be beneficial. And it even goes into the portion about, you know, recycling and repurposing and you know, reusing what would have otherwise been known as waste. You could make perfectly efficient machines and perfectly efficient infrastructure that even your garbage that you thought was garbage now becomes a vital resource that could be turned into fuel or whatever, you know, and actually used to purify water, you know, in worst case scenario. So you would think that the governments of the world would want to encourage people like what Sweden has done with their people, to encourage them to be part of, you know, a solution instead of going out building these massive bunkers in case of war or doomsday to only house the elite. We build the entire infrastructure to, you know, take care of everybody. You know, that's the difference. This is why I wanted to share this one with Sweden, because they had enough bunkers at one point that would be able to, you know, take care of the entire population. You didn't have to have a lottery ticket or a special ID or purpose to be able to be saved. They would take care of everyone. And to me, that's the ultimate right there. Let's keep going with this.
We have been reducing all times from 700,000 to be now 50,000 people in the armed forces, including the home guard. It's not enough if something should happen to Sweden. The big picture mission is to have them ready if something should happen, well trained and filled up, you know, to 100%.
While some volunteers train in military combat, Lotta, a trained nurse, tests others in emergency first aid. We have been naive. People thought that, nothing's going to happen to us. We're safe. And then we lost all that knowledge.
Det var jag som gav det där i åren att vi åker ner till staben, informerar staben att vi behöver en ambulans.
För det blev ingen riktigt bra miss där. Vad var det som hade hänt?
There's clearly still a lot to learn, but today is just a simulation.
Så det är viktigt att veta vad ingår i min roll liksom. Så. Men vi hittar våra punkter där vi behöver öva mer. Superbra.
Before I leave, I ask the lieutenant colonel if he thinks they're prepared.
If war did come tomorrow, how do you think you would go?
Well, tomorrow we are not so many. We do try to do our best, but also to get other countries to come and help us. That's for sure. We are very vulnerable, and so that's something been discussed quite a lot in Sweden the last years.
While the lieutenant colonel says they will call on neighbouring countries for help, Sweden still isn't part of any formal alliances. But back in Stockholm, this isn't something the country's defence minister is concerned about.
Would you like to see Sweden sign NATO?
We are a non-allied nation, and we will be a non-allied nation, and I think that is the best for the stability in our part of Europe.
How serious a threat, then, is Russia to Sweden's security?
I think the realities are very clear. You have this aggression to Georgia 2008, you have this annexation of Crimea against international law and regulations, you have this war going on in Ukraine. You have a Russian leadership that are ready to use military power to fulfill political goals.
Are you concerned?
I see it is necessary to invest and have a new strategy for the defense forces in Sweden, to invest in upgrading our national capability and deepening the cooperation with others. And the most strategic decision we have taken is to reactivate conscription service in Sweden, and we have that since 1st of January 2018.
Mm. What do you say then to citizens who are concerned that you aren't doing enough?
You build military capability step by step. It takes a long time. We invest now a huge amount of money in military investments. So I feel when I meet people that we have a real support for the governmental position and what we are doing today.
Sweden's military spending is actually at a historic low. It's only 1% of GDP, which is less than NATO recommends. So government moves to revive total defence, a cold comfort for many preppers. Back in the north, I'm meeting one prepper who's taking radical steps to move permanently off-grid. Hi, Andreas.
Hi. Welcome.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
Oh, I feel like I'm entering Narnia right now.
Well, you are one of seven people who knows this place.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel very privileged. I understand that preppers keep their bug outs pretty anonymous.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, mostly because you don't want unwanted visitors during a crisis.
I did some extensive research before I bought this place, looking at population density and what roads led to this place and did not lead to this place. So it's off the beaten track, so to speak. I also did check up on military targets around the areas I was looking for, to be safe from, well, bombs and such.
Well, this is part of my food storage. So these are all canned goods and some dry stuff. Bullen special sausage, which is a huge divider in the prepper community of Sweden, depending on if you like it or hate it. Most people hate it, I suppose. But I don't. I tend to only prep things that I like to eat. It's useless to prep things that you don't like. I mean, what's the point of eating food you don't like when things are going to hell in a handbasket?
Unlike Lotta, Andreas has been prepping for more than a decade. Prompted by the 2008 financial crisis, he now has enough food hidden around this cabin to help him survive out here for 2 years.
Even though we see signs that things are taking a turn for the worse, we don't act, we just talk. And I can't trust the government to take care of me as it stands till now.
Well, I got everything on this list, actually, that I have in my storage. So, for starters, I have like a quarter of a ton of rice. That's around 900,000 calories, 40 kilos of sugar. I have 42 kilos of ravioli. Ideally, I would like to have the double amount of foodstuffs that I have now. So, let's say 4 years. Then I would feel a bit more on the safe side. Mm-hmm. So I have a bit more work to do.
What's on the menu for tonight, Andreas?
Well, it's pea soup and hard bread. Yeah, I know it looks a bit gross, but it will be fine when it's done, I promise.
An extraordinary amount of thought has gone into every inch of this cabin. It's a remarkable achievement in self-sufficiency.
Wow. How long can this last for, Andreas?
5-6 years, perhaps.
But Andreas knows not everyone sees it that way yet.
Right now we are in a state of flux, or a change, in Sweden. Though most people that are not prepared, well, they have a journey to make, so to speak.
So what would you say then to people who still think prepping is a little bit crazy?
I encourage people to look at the real world around them, because Sweden is not a bubble isolated in the world. Look at what happened in Sarajevo and the former Republic of Yugoslavia. Look at what happened in Syria. Look at all the civil wars that you have throughout history. Look at Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina. I mean, I could just keep on going. So things can happen, and they can happen here as well. So learn from history.
Should people be scared?
No, definitely not. Never be scared. That's counterproductive.
Just eat pea soup.
Eat pea soup and be happy.
Staring down the worst case scenario, perhaps there's a certain courage to what Andreas and Lotte do. Far from crazy, it's even a little admirable.
What if war and the worst thing never happens? That's great if it doesn't happen. At least I will know that I had the ability to support myself and my loved ones. And knowing that, that's a great feeling.
Will you be disappointed?
No. The other way around, I will be very happy. Isn't that what we all want? To live in peace.
So there you go. There's all kinds of reasons why people should actually prepare for things. But there's all kinds of reasons why you should do it as a community, above and beyond everything else like that. Because if you have an entire community that is going to be protected for worst case scenario situation, then you don't have to worry about all the people trying to come in and, steal with what you got, and all the craziness that comes in and all these different war-torn zones and, impoverished nations that are struggling for resources. If we took everything that we've learned throughout all these years, all these decades, generations, and we took all the technologies that we have available to us right here at this point in time, and started implementing those towards building infrastructures that would be self-sustained, which is doable. It is all doable. We have all the technology necessary to resolve all these issues. But the thing about it is, we keep waiting around for governments or companies or bankers or all these people here to do it for us. And we can't do that. They're obviously not trustworthy. They've been doing this for years. There's bunkers out there, folks, that have been long since abandoned because, they cut military budgets or whatever, and those infrastructures are already still in place. They don't say, hey, to the general public, we got this old bunker here that we've since abandoned because we built a new one. Why don't some private entities take this thing over and do some upgrades on it and get it ready so that somebody else, kind of like handing the old car off to somebody or the old house off to somebody who needs it or whatever. That's not what they think about. Government wants to keep what government's got. They want to keep what they got secret. And you see, there's always the potential war because we've witnessed it so many times. And there's always potential of all kinds of other craziness going on, whether it be man-made or natural, it doesn't matter. What matters is that how many people can we actually save in a worst case scenario? We should be able to save every single one of them, you know, and then you wouldn't have people in your community that had to come and try to steal from you because they knew that they were going to be protected as well. You know, they had a place in the deal. They had a part in it. But I don't know what it's going to take in order to get people to realize that we need each other as much as we do. And with all the technologies that we have that could withstand tornadoes, hurricanes, floods, you know, tsunamis and earthquakes and, you know, even solar storms and all that. We have all those technologies. We have knowledge on how to do amazing things. Insulation that would blow your doors off. Keep the heat out or the cool air in, whichever way you want it, vice versa. We got the technologies to do that. We got to pull the most brilliant minds in this world together and have us as the people pulling our resources and building things like this. We could do this. We could build an ark, essentially, that would take care of everybody. Even if you lived out on a you know, 40-acre piece of land or something like that, you was out in the middle of that, your ark could float up and you guys could join up with the next one. You'd be able to merge it together like they do the space station or whatever. You know, you could have it set up so that if you could get to each other, you could lock in and share your resources there. There ain't no reason for, you know, anybody to be left out in the cold or the zombie apocalypse or even an alien invasion for that matter if we all would to use everything we've got wisely. You know, there's all kinds of possibilities, even to the extent, or like in my area, there's a lot of flooding going on down here that's pretty much got all the farmland in a certain area underwater. We could build farmland that would literally float every single time the water rise. They'd keep the plants up above the water level at all times, you know, just leave the roots dangling down in the water so that you wouldn't even have to worry about, you know, the plant not surviving. It's doable. And you'd still, if you built it properly, you could still drive your tractors and your combines and stuff on it in order to be able to harvest those crops. So there wouldn't be no reason for any flood to take out a lot of the food crops. And the same thing would apply to in drought scenarios. We have the capability to move water from any place we want. We could build infrastructure that if this site over here was going through a drought, we could pump excess water from the flood zone over that way to water the deal. It's all about whether or not we want to take the time and the investment in order to come together to ensure that everyone can benefit. We have tanker trucks where if we needed to, we could move water from state to state. We have trains that have tankers on them that we could move water from state to state. And if we did this kind of deal, then you wouldn't hear anything about, oh, there's a terrible drought over here. There's a terrible flood over here, and we're going to have high food prices because the doggone weather or whatever. We could basically roll with the punches of nature and still survive and thrive like you wouldn't imagine. But once again, it always comes down to that holy grail of everything. And that is that we have to realize that we as humans need each other more than we can possibly imagine. And if we work together like a colony of ants, they seem to do really well. They seem to thrive no matter what happens. They figure out a way. And there's always somebody in there that's trying to protect each other. So anyway, I'm going to take a quick break and then come back and see if I can't sum this up. And hopefully you've enjoyed this and it's been, you know, thought-provoking. And maybe we can get the word out to the world that if we really want to solve our problems as humans, It's doable. We just have to want to do it. That's the only key. There's a lot of waste in construction and companies that there's a lot of materials that you could actually get for free that you could incorporate into your plan in order to, you know, build a self-contained structure that would, you know, basically protect your people in any type of event. And, you know, so the resources are there. You probably have resources that, with my resources, would, you know, keep the lights on. And so we combine all of what we have, our knowledge, our resources, and our manpower together, and there's nothing that we can't accomplish. You would be amazed at what humanity could actually do if they really seriously put their mind to it. We could do things. We don't have to lose anyone. We don't have to lose anyone to war or weather or anything like that, you know, minus every once in a while an unforeseen circumstance, an unfortunate, you know, accident or whatever. But on a whole, as society, we don't have a section that gets to go up in the bunker and a section that has to stay out there and fend for themselves. And there is nobody starving. There is nobody, you know, dying of thirst. There's nobody that has to be homeless unless they choose to be homeless. So anyway, I'm going to take a quick break, and I'll be back with you. You're listening to Mad Science. Stay tuned.
What was that? Stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one hand.
Ooh,
one hand.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one hand.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope. Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
nothing happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, watch that sound. Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and a carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop.
Is the dream. The dream is to bring brilliant minds from every nation together to solve the world's problems, one positive pebble at a time. It will be we, the people of the world, that bring about true change, peace, and love to all. Governments never solve any problem, only create them. Wars, starvation, sickness, oppression, financial slavery, death and destruction is what governments do best. When all the military might of nations is used to destroy other nations, the question has to be asked, why not use that military strength for good? Feed the hungry, shelter the homeless, heal the sick, and so forth. True representation of truth, freedom, and justice comes from we the people, and it never came from slick-talking politicians that say whatever they have to get elected, and then regulate away your freedoms. There is no reason to have starving babies in the world of today. Yet, it goes on. There's no reason for wars and sickness, yet it continues. We as the people must stop feeding that beast that is eating humanity alive. We the people of all nations have the power to bring about a literal heaven on earth. You as an individual have more power than you can possibly imagine. You have the power of the spoken word. You have the power of the pen. The power of action, and most of all, the power of love. It is time to use this power to make our world a better place. We are the founding fathers, mothers, sisters, and brothers of our children, and of our children's children's future. Into the future and beyond, what we do today will define the world that they live in tomorrow. Let us from every nation come together and make that future a great one.
Yeah, let us come together and make that future a great one. So, I played out a whole bunch of different types of scenarios and different types of things that they said were doomsday possibilities. I played out what everybody's plans were and all these different types of things. Governments, they've already got their infrastructure in place to keep continuity of government and to keep control and that kind of deal in the worst case scenario. So I'm asking the question today, you know, laugh out loud, doomsday sucks. And doomsday does suck because it's you know, it's usually the average Joe that one that, you know, suffers through scenarios such as that. And I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's necessary that with all the knowledge that we've got, that we as a society, our communities, can't come together and, you know, build and pull our resources together to ensure, you know, why wait till the last minute when something goes wrong in order to try to fix it? When you see there's a possibility that something could happen, then maybe it's a good idea to plan for it. You know, a lot of us, we spend hundreds if not thousands of dollars on different types of insurance. Health insurance, life insurance, you know, auto insurance. We have all this insurance for case something happens so that we don't become financially devastated, you know, when we're not physically able to work or whatever. So we put tons and tons of money into the system. For what? You know? What if we had a community-based insurance program that would say that if anything happens to you, we'll all pitch in and we'll take care of you? Or what if we had a community-based system that instead of us having to pay all that money into all these different insurance agencies that are basically ripping you off with every type of technicality they can so they don't have to pay you in such an emergency? What if we took those funds and those finances and we focused them into building a really strong infrastructure for our communities that where we decided we would take care of each other no matter what happened? You know, you won't have to worry about, you know, fires burning down people's houses and they suddenly become homeless, because we would build the houses to be fireproof. We'd build the houses to be floodproof. We'd build our communities to be able to, you know, interlock with each other. You know, if the city was for some reason to be flooded, the whole entire city would raise up. It would float right there in the spot. And if need be, it could go higher or lower depending on what was going on. We have technologies and capabilities of doing amazing things. But the most of us, we spend all of our finances, our funds, you know, trying to feed the infrastructure that is in place that, you know, is shabby at best. If we really thought about this in a serious manner and we came together on these round tables and we decided to you know, work together. You know, we got Skype capabilities to where we can get brilliant people on Skype and we can have video conferences everywhere. And we could do this thing. You know, there's things that go to waste that don't need to go to waste. There's fruits that fall off of trees that never, you know, never get eaten. Well, nature takes them back. The insects and the wildlife will eat them. But it's just what I'm trying to say is nature always provides an overabundance of everything that we need, and whatever we don't use, nature recycles. And so we have the knowledge and the capability of literally building perfectly efficient and self-sustaining societies. But something keeps us separated. Something keeps us from wanting to come together and make this happen. You know, when there's communities out there that they can't even get fresh water or food for their children, society, humanity's failed. And that's sad. Because there are organizations out there that go out and rescue food that's about to expire that they want to get out there to people who can use it, you know. And if we did this on a regular scale, if we had it set up to where, you know, it could only be stored for this long and you had to, you know, give it to a charity or something, or sell it for a fraction of its value to people who can actually use it, then we'd have a whole lot better, you know, results of what's going on in this world. I mean, we got these capabilities, folks. We honestly do. We have the science to back it up. We have the resources. We have the manpower. And when I say we, I mean we. I don't mean the government. I don't mean the bankers. I don't mean the companies and corporations. I mean you and me. If I only got a dollar in my pocket and you got a dollar in your pocket, that's $2. You know? And all of us come together, we put our dollars together, and we make things happen. One community at a time. Even if you choose a community, a special community, just to test the theory of what I'm saying, and other communities, they all pitch in, and they uplift this one, and when that one gets up there and it begins to thrive and is financially capable, it reciprocates to the next town over and does that. But it's all done by the people. It ain't done by the banks. It's not done by begging and borrowing and stealing. It's done because we pulled our resources and we made it so. These are all possibilities. And it doesn't have to come under some sort of one world government or flag or religion or ideology. Just under an idea that why should the elite have their own plan in place and be able to basically run up into bunkers that we paid for with machinery and equipment and food and everything that we as tax-paying citizens paid for. And that we built and we created. Where's ours? Why do we got to be left out with the zombies? Why do we got to be left out with the aliens or the invading force or the natural disaster? Why aren't we preparing each other for any possibility to ensure that humanity strives? That humanity succeeds and we can see how far we can actually go? These are the things that I think about on a daily basis. These are the things that I gather up these podcasts and I gather up this information and videos and I try to share with everybody because I'm hoping to inspire and open some minds to possibilities that we have the solutions necessary. We can fix it. But the thing is, we have to want to fix it. We have to want to take time out of our busy life. You know, it doesn't even matter if you're in a wheelchair. If you got a brain and you can talk and you can type and communicate, you could share a message. You could share a link. You could bring people to the table. You know? Everybody has a purpose. Everybody is useful. And if we learn that, if we learn that one valuable lesson, then this is going to be so much of a better world than you can possibly imagine. And we can, like they say on the Star Trek deal, boldly go where no man has gone before. I want to see a situation where we the people literally bring about a heaven on earth. A utopia, so to speak. It is doable. You've been listening to Mad Science. If you've been inspired in the least by this show, please share the link. The podcast will be up. Stay tuned for the Music with Kara Hour. Peace and love, everybody. Take care.
Was that ant that stood up to me?
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh.
One ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant. Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.